Hey, I'm Mark A. Altman.
And I'm Darren Dockerman.
And I'm Ashley Miller.
And we're here to tell you about an exciting new documentary from, well, us. To celebrate the upcoming 60th anniversary of the filming of The Cage, we put together the ultimate love letter to Star Trek, in which we boldly go to filming locations from almost six decades of Star Trek. We are going to crisscross the globe, or at least Southern California, in search of the coolest Star Trek filming locations. We're not only going to tell you the history of these amazing locations, but we're going to tell you about the episodes that were filmed there and give you details you never knew.
It's a regular landing party from Vasquez Rocks to the Sepulveda Reclamation Dam to Bronson Caves and Golden Gate Park and even the Embarcadero, where Chekhov looked for the nuclear vessels. You'll go with us on an incredible adventure as we crisscross the country in search of adventure and food, occasionally, while sharing stories about the making of hundreds of incredible locations and episodes.
Plus, you never know who'll drop by, drop in, drop out to share their memories and maybe even their food. We've already announced burlesque superstar Hazel Honeysuckle. But you can expect an array of Star Trek stars, writers, directors, and superfans, not just ourselves, as featured on our hit podcast, Inglourious Trexperts, to drop by and share their own stories as well.
Well, we are truly going to run because we are going to make this film and we're going to make it happen today with your help. There may not be money in the future, but there is now. Send us your gold plus latinum because this is a chance to help us make the trek today. And rest assured, this is a team of industry professionals who, like Captain Jellico, will get it done.
As most of you know, Mark's Greatest Geek Year Ever documentary just debuted to rave reviews on the CW, and he has been a showrunner and writer-producer on such popular series as Pandora, The Librarians, and Castle.
And I personally was shocked to learn that Darren was an associate producer and visual effects supervisor on some movie called Star Trek The Motion Picture Director's Edition, and he's a Hollywood concept designer on major feature films and TV series, including Master and Commander, X3, and Star Trek Picard.
You may not know this, but Ashley Edward Miller is the screenwriter for such blockbusters as Thor, X-Men First Class, and the showrunner of Dota Dragon's Blood on Netflix. Join us on the ultimate road trip. Or is it a road trek? Either way, keep on trekking, ingloriously, of course. And join us on Kickstarter or at makethetrek.com and treksportsplus.com for more information on how to make the trek happen.
Would you like to know more?
I would.
Sure would.
Sure you would. Join us at San Diego Comic-Con, GalaxyCon in Raleigh, North Carolina, and Las Vegas's 57-year mission. For more details, all summer long, along with the super toys, and grow stronger through the share.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey, this is Mark Altman of Inglourious Trexperts in the 430 movie. And if you're a fan of our podcast, you don't want to miss Deck 78, available now by subscribing at treksportsplus.com. This is a bonus podcast full of great discussions about popular culture, film, and television. By your command, here's a sneak peek.
Well, and then there's an interesting issue of nature versus nurture with Superman that's been explored in different ways. And I've always thought that Superman isn't so much a Kryptonian as he is a Kansan. Mm-hmm. Because the character that Superman is, his values, his morals came from Ma and Pa Kent being raised in Kansas. And that made him you know, a good person, and they instilled that sense of responsibility that he has, even though Jor-El later in the Christopher Reeve movie, you know, also, you know, gave him instruction on that sort of thing.
He was like his math tutor, though.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. But even like when John Schneider played Jonathan on Smallville, It was that nurturing of Clark, of the morality of what is right and what is wrong. So by the time he leaves Smallville, whether it's in Superman the movie or whether it's any version of this story, he's ready in a sense. He may not be ready to be Superman per se, but in terms of the goalpost, he knows what it is. He knows what he's got to do, and he's got the moral compass. That's the important thing. He's coming out as Superman for the first time, no matter how he does. So a villain kicks his ass, blasts him with something, whatever it may be. The moral compass is already there. And that to me is, I think, one of the things I really enjoy about the character and always have. So,
what, you know, obviously a lot of this stuff is very well documented. What are some of the things in the book do you feel either surprised you or you think that people reading this will be like, really, I had no idea?
I mean, you like you said, a lot of it is well documented. And I think it's the digging in deeper in this book, I hope that is going to be a little surprising to people, like getting that full history. That being said, the rabbit hole I fell down in writing this thing, and I probably spent the first 4 months of this book working on, was the Siegel and Shuster versus DC thing. Mm-hmm. And I worked so hard to make sure that it was balanced, because if you really look at the history, There's so much more to the big bad DC Comics and the poor creators who were ripped off. And they were. I mean, you know, even though at the time it was business as usual. The comparison I always make is it's like the actors from Gilligan's Island. They were paid for the first 5 reruns of every episode, and that was it. Or the actors from Star Trek, even. Yeah. Or Roddenberry himself with Star Trek until Next Gen, and he made all his money. But the truth is, you signed a deal because that's the way the situation was. They signed the rights for $130 for the 13 pages, but they still worked with DC for 10 years. And they made the equivalent of $6 million, if you adjust for inflation, over the course of actually 9 years before they launched a lawsuit and got fired and lost everything, basically.
So subscribe today at TreksFirstPlus.com and don't miss a single episode of Deck 78. Fire the Rockets. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
This is Darren Doctorman.
And this is Ashley Miller.
And we are the Inglorious
Trexperts.
He's been depressed. All of a sudden, he can't do anything.
Why are you depressed, Harvey?
Tell Dr. Flicker. It's something he read.
Something you read, huh?
The universe is expanding.
The universe is expanding?
Well, the universe is everything. And if it's expanding, someday it will break apart and that will be the end of everything.
What is that your business? He stopped doing his homework.
What's the point?
What has the universe got to do with it? You're here in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is not expanding.
It won't be expanding for billions of years yet, Alvy. And we've got to try and enjoy ourselves while we're here, huh? Huh?
And today, we are truly going to go where no one has gone before. We are talking to James Fanson. Now, he may not be a household name, but he should be, because he spent his career developing ground and space-based telescopes to explore the heavens and inform our understanding of the universe. He spent more than 30 years at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he helped repair the Hubble telescope's blurred vision, led the design of the Spitzer Space Telescope, Hubble's infrared companion, and he even served as the project manager. That's like, you remember project manager? What was that? The Apprentice? We're not going to talk about The Apprentice. He was a project. I would have made a nice apprentice comment
you know, 10 years ago. Now I'm just going to skip over the project manager of the Kepler mission, which determined that rocky planets like Earth are common in the galaxy. He's currently the project manager on the Sphere's Space Telescope mission. That's not the club in Vegas, the Sphere.
No. Or the movie base of the Michael
This Crow. Is not where U2 is doing their residency. It's the Space Telescope mission scheduled to launch in early 2025.
Well, and you mentioned the rocky planet discovery, but there's also...
the Rocky Horror.
Rocky.
The Apollo Creed mission.
Yeah.
My prediction for the mission? Pain. So, in 2025, the Sphere Space Telescope will measure the large-scale structure of the universe. And of course, all this is because he, as a youth, was inspired by Star Trek. And we've heard these stories so often. Star Trek inspired me. It changed my life. It made me want to be, you know, an engineer or a doctor or, a writer, you know, or all these things. And here's a case of somebody, James, who was inspired by Star Trek to go into this field and has brought us these amazing imageries and enhanced our understanding of the cosmos. And it's really an extraordinary thing because for us, Star Trek is an incredible waste of time, right?
Little thing we did at a lark 30 years ago.
You know, it's fun. We enjoy it. We spend way too much time talking about it. But here's someone who took his love of Star Trek and actually made something of himself.
Go out and do something with yourself.
And so he's like the less crazy Richard Daystrom. So
it's hard not to be.
But I think it's an absolutely delightful conversation. We're deeply appreciated to Darren for bringing him to the show. I think you're really going to find it fascinating, for lack of a better word. And now, without any further ado, let's bring on James Vanson of NASA and JPL to talk about his love of Star Trek and how it inspired his career and how it's inspiring the future every day. So, James, welcome aboard. We're happy to have you. You know, obviously, a huge part of Star Trek, and particularly you saw the 70s, the passion for space and the space program that was instilled in people from the original Star Trek. I mean, to this day, I still remember that great campaign that renamed the space shuttle the Enterprise. You know, that unfortunately never actually went into space, but
glider.
It was yeah, they seemed like a triumph. Tell us a little bit about how Star Trek inspired you to do what you're doing today and why you feel it resonated so much.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be with you. Star Trek is, is very much a product of its era. And the 1960s was a time of great optimism in certain directions and great trauma in other directions. I was not quite 8 years old when the first Star Trek episode premiered. And I remember watching the coming attractions and the advertising for Star Trek. And it was such an appealing world that I have very clear memories of watching the premiere on a small black and white television. But it represented, I think, part of the era where the United States was advancing in its actual space program. The Gemini program was in progress. The Apollo program was to follow. And so space was just very much in the news and on the minds of people. It was a national priority. The whole Apollo program was started as a national political priority. Star Trek was the extension of that. It was a vision of what the future of the human race could be. Mm-hmm. And it was a world that I very much wanted to live in. It was a world where what mattered was what you had to bring to the game. It didn't matter what your race was, what your color was, what your background was. And it represented, in some sense, a unification of not just people from the Earth, but people from other planets and other civilizations going forth to explore the galaxy. And to me, that just had a tremendous amount of romance. And watching the space program for real unfold, I just decided I wanted to be a part of that future. I wanted to be engaged in space exploration. I wanted to do my part to move us in the direction of having a real Star Trek in our future.
And how did you go about doing that when you were inspired by Star Trek with this love of astronomy and of space exploration? What were the next steps when, you know, after high school for you to become, you know, Captain Kirk or Mr. Spock or, you know, explore, you know, boldly go?
Well, what I did was, you know, I recognized early on that space exploration is an engineering challenge. It's a technical science challenge. And so I studied what we'd call STEM subjects in school. I enrolled in an engineering school in college. I studied as much as I could about the universe and about astronomy. I became an amateur astronomer and joined the local astronomy club. And just pursued that goal through college. And then when I was a senior in college, that was the time when Voyager, the spacecraft that was built to explore the out into the deep solar system.
Right, that fell into a black hole and then came back looking for all that is learnable, knowing all that is knowable.
Right, well, that was Voyager 6.
Right. Yeah, Mark.
I think it was Voyager 1, maybe it was Voyager 2, that was approaching Saturn when I was a senior in college. And the arrival of whichever one was the first to get to Saturn, the arrival of a spacecraft up close to the ringed planet, which is really the jewel of our solar system, was so enthralling to me that, you know, I was just glued to these programs. So there were these broadcasts that originated from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory that would interview the scientists involved in the mission, describe what you were looking at as the images came back almost in real time, and they were streamed out to broadcast television. And I just thought, wow, that's the place I want to work. And so when I was looking for a graduate school, I discovered that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is operated for NASA by Caltech in Pasadena. And so I applied to Caltech to go to graduate school. And they accepted me. And for my thesis research topic, I selected something of interest to JPL. And when I graduated, I just naturally transitioned over to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So that was the path. It was sort of inspired by just the sense of romantic adventure associated with exploring the heavens.
Right. When we talked before about the fact that that in the late 60s, when Star Trek was being broadcast, it's interesting that the public perception of it is sort of exactly the same as the public's perception of the manned space shots, because the public is just as separate from that as they are from Star Trek. So these are sort of equally weighted events for people to view. And I talked about this with Shatner one time, and he didn't understand why people had just as much reverence for Star Trek characters as they did for the astronauts. I said, well, there's no difference. There's absolutely no difference, because they are mythic figures, all of them. And I think that that's an interesting thing because of the way that, Star Trek featured in several episodes talking about the space program, and that there was a very close relationship between NASA and Star Trek. The actors would often visit various launch sites and party with the astronauts. And it seems that they were sort of symbiotic to some extent. the interest in Star Trek fueled the interest in NASA, and vice versa. Did you have any feeling about that when you were watching the show as a kid? Did that have any relation to you?
Well, of course, I didn't know at the time the details of what was going on behind the scenes in the production of Star Trek. But, you know, there were probably hundreds of thousands of people like me that were caught up in the romance of space exploration.
Star Trek has inspired many real-life explorers, including NASA scientists, engineers, and astronauts, who often cite Star Trek as inspiring them to focus on space exploration.
From Earth's largest federation of scientists, engineers, and explorers, we congratulate Star Trek on its 50th anniversary.
From the birthplace of V'ger.
So from all of us here at NASA headquarters.
As Star Trek continues to push the final frontiers of our imagination.
Happy 50th Star Trek!
Happy 50th anniversary, Star Trek!
Happy 50th anniversary, Star Trek!
We set a course to seek out the strange new worlds in our own universe. Warp Factor 9.
Engage!
Happy anniversary, Star Trek! We're boldly going where no one has gone before!
Going boldly for 50 years! Live long and prosper!
Live long and prosper!
Happy 50th anniversary, Star Trek!
Live long and prosper!
And as you said, the characters in Star Trek were just projections forward in time of the heroic activities going on in the real space program at the time. So I'm not surprised that there turned out to be connections between the original series and NASA, and not just NASA. You know, there were other entities that were also involved in the space program. There was the National Air and Space Museum. There was the whole aerospace industry, and as well as the Defense Department in the 60s. For a while in the 60s, had their own space program. They were flying the X-15 and lifting bodies and we're training astronauts at Edwards Air Force Base. So, these were all going on at the same time. It was all in this sort of zeitgeist of the time.
Yeah.
Well, so not surprised that there we've discovered that there are connections there. And of course, just like Stanley Kubrick was trying to bring reality to his movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, and he went off and hired people out of Wernher von Braun's group at the Marshall Space Flight Center at NASA. So too, Gene Roddenberry wanted that realism in Star Trek, and he reached out to many people, including people at NASA, people at the Harvey Lind was a consultant from the Rand Corporation.
Right.
So there were a lot of people that were helping Gene bring that sense of reality to this program.
Well, let's kind of stay with the romance of space exploration for a moment. You know, like you said, there's a lot of people who were very inspired by Star Trek to become involved with the space program. And they did become astronauts and engineers and scientists and you name it, and that's what they did. I think that, the first instinct when you're a kid is you want to get up there yourself. You want to be, out there in the final frontier. Was there a moment for you when you went from, first of all, did you ever have that moment where you're like, you know what, I want to be an astronaut? Or was there a moment when you said, maybe that part isn't for me, but wow, like I want to get involved in the area that you wound up in telescopes and imagery and kind of bringing those pictures back to people? And now, in your life, in your career, kind of where do you find that romance of space exploration?
That's an interesting question. I can remember, and maybe you've had this experience too, when you're going up through school, particularly in elementary school, and they'll ask you from time to time, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, what do you envision doing when you grow up? And I remember one year writing down that I wanted to be the chief engineer on a space station, orbiting the Earth. So, when I was very small, of course, I wanted to be Captain Kirk. I wanted to be the people, you know, at the frontier. Later on, as I got more into, you know, an education, finishing college into graduate school and going into work, you know, I realized that the people who become astronauts, they spend a huge amount of their time training for missions. And compared to the actual amount of time that they spend in space, it's a little different now when you've got people that are spending a long period of time on the space station. They spend an enormous amount of their time preparing to fly compared to the amount of time they're actually flying. And I found that less interesting as my career developed. I found what I was actually doing in helping to build the machines that project humanity into space, whether it's a robotic mission or not. I found plenty of romance in that work. I can tell you, you know, I've worked on many space telescope projects, several space telescope projects. And that moment when the first image comes down after you've launched it into space and you've done whatever deployments are necessary, you've turned it on, it's, you know, cooled down to the proper temperature, you've checked it out. When that first image comes down, you know, it's a heart-stopping moment. So there's just been an enormous amount of satisfaction in doing what I do. So I lost the need to be an astronaut somewhere along that journey.
It's so funny to hear that, because I always think about the story that Walter Koenig tells. He says, oh, all the actors were inspired, you know, inspired a generation to Captain Kirk to, you know, join, you know, be leaders and heroes, and Spock to be in the sciences, and, you know, and then DeForest Kelly used to hear how you inspired me to be a doctor, and you know, all that she says, but nobody wanted to be like Chekhov, right? Scotty, engineers. He said, nobody wanted anything. One day this person comes up to me and says, you inspired me in Star Trek to do what I do. And he's like, really? What do you do? I work for the CIA, became a spy because with the Russians. And it was so funny. I mean, because he always has this chip on his shoulder that, oh, woe is Chekhov. Nobody, you know, he's always getting a second trip. I just love that story because it's true. I mean, each of these characters are so iconic and they inspire a generation of people. So I wonder, from your perspective, your contemporaries, did you find that they also were Star Trek fans? And is it something that came up over the course of what you do, where people would, you know, I know certainly people on this show from time to time may reference Star Trek quotes and talk in Star Trek quotes and talk about things that happened in Star Trek. Is that something that happens internally in the sciences as well?
It absolutely does. And, you know, my story is not unique. I'm surrounded by people in my line of work who, you know, particularly those in my age cohort, who were similarly inspired to go into science and engineering by Star Trek and by the space program. And, you know, it was just a couple of months ago where someone on my team made the comment that he was struggling to build something with stone knives and bear skins. And of course, I picked up the reference immediately, and he was surprised that I picked up the reference. But there are plenty of people out there, I think, that have that same connection.
That's very funny. When I met you at a convention a couple months ago, I found it so interesting that you were just as at home talking about space technology and you know, theories in astronomical realms as you were about just regular Star Trek stuff. And I thought that was a lot of fun, and that's one of the reasons why we asked you to come on. What's the question? Do you have a certain group of friends that are able to geek out with you, or do you keep it relatively low key?
Well, I have friends that I geek out with. Most of the time at my work, though, I keep things relatively low key. You know, I have when I was young, I was really captured by science fiction in the cinema, you know, in the theater and on television, more so than reading science fiction, because by the 60s, there was a lot on television. There was a moment where I was very interested in going into motion picture and television production. And I always had an interest in photography. So this intersection between science fiction and cinema has always been an interest of mine. And I was involved in some, you know, sort of amateur or independent film production. One of them where interestingly, Jimmy Doohan was starring in that production, which was never released, by the way. But somewhere out there are reels of film of Jimmy Doohan in this thing. So I have like two spheres of friends that I geek out with. There are those that are in the space reality business that have followed a career path similar to mine. And then there are the people that are sort of in the Hollywood direction, in the cinema direction, in model building and so on. And I geek out with those people too. So when they come into LA, you know, we'll hang out and go visit people and do things. I have sort of an equal interest in both of those directions.
And I'm sure there is a Venn diagram of overlap between both of them. And most of those are Tom Hanks. he fits pretty squarely into both of those.
I got to ask you.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
That when Mike Okuda and Denise and Dave Rossi were upgrading the effect, I don't know if I want to use the word upgrading, when they were doing their version of the Star Trek Special Edition with the new effects, one of the things that they were adamant about, one of the things they did, was we're going to update the planets using everything we've learned now with space photography. So instead of these sort of painterly, gaseous, you know, colorful kaleidoscopes, we're going to use real astronomical data that has been collected since the original show. And my question to you is, does the fantasy of Star Trek that you grew up on and loved so much in the 60s become lessened or collide with what you now know to be real science? Because of course, as ahead of its time as Star Trek was, there was also a lot that it got wrong. Can you just enjoy it for what it is? Because it's like those people who say, you know, if it's anything, you know, Star Wars, I can't watch it because there's sound in space. I can hear the explosions and that wouldn't happen, right? So like, can you enjoy Star Trek for what it is, knowing how much of it is not real or is never going to be real?
I absolutely enjoy Star Trek for what it is. it's a product of its era. And it was very progressive for its time in many ways. And it doesn't bother me that, you know, the visual effects are not of the quality that we would produce today. Although I appreciate what they did with the remastering or the Blu-ray edition of the Star Trek series. And so you have the choice of watching the original visual effects or you can watch the CGI. And I enjoy them both. And sometimes I like the episodes better with the new effects. And sometimes I like them better with the original effects. So I can enjoy it either way.
My question is, and I've always wondered about this, is that is the fantastical world presented by Star Trek a bonus to the enjoyment and support of the space program, or is the fact that the space program doesn't really deliver the future as quickly as some people would want, is that a bit of a downer for fans of fiction? Do you understand what I'm talking about? Is Star Trek encouraging people to support the space program, or is it making them feel like things aren't happening fast enough?
I think it encourages people. That's my private, you know, my personal view.
Yeah.
There's a long tradition of a symbiosis between science fiction and science reality. we would not have had an Apollo program if there hadn't been the science fiction of the 50s, or you know, actually starting in the 30s and 40s into the 50s, that helped prepare people by allowing them to envision what could be done in the future. So I think that without the Star Trek, without the vision, you don't have something to aspire to. So I think that, yes, Star Trek is aspirational. We don't have warp drive. We don't have transporter effects and so on. But we have people that are working on warp drive and trying to understand the physics, that we need to understand, you know, beyond the current knowledge of physics to be able possibly to do those types of things. So I don't feel bad that we don't have warp drive today. I think that these things can take a long time to develop. Absolutely. And so long as you have something to guide you, an inspiration,
a direction,
to show you a direction to go, I'm okay with it taking as long as it takes.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because so much has been made of how Star Trek inspired so many developments in technology and science. Obviously, it's been stated ad nauseum. The cell phone was inspired by the communicator, you know, sliding doors, you know, a computer responding to the sound of your voice, you know, which all is now completely ordinary, but at the time was extraordinary. So I kind of would love for you to sort of grade on a curve some of the things that haven't come to pass and how likely you think they are to happen. So, you know, you just talked about warp drive. This is something people are working on. Will we be able to go between planets, you know, with it, like Star Trek, where we're able to go beyond the speed of light or a warp bubble and go, obviously in the time, in the kind of time the Enterprise is like going down the block to 7-Eleven, you know, for us, it would take hundreds of thousands of years to go where they're going. Do you think this is something that is potentially feasible? And then I would ask you the same about transporter technology and holodecks and some of the other technology that was postulated by Star Trek.
Well, these are interesting topics, and, you know, I'll give you my own view of them.
Yes.
But I think that the fact that we don't have these technologies now should not necessarily be a reason for us not to work on them. If you had traveled back in time 100 years and talked to people about the technology we have today, it would seem possibly impossible to them, you know, just an incredible leap forward. There are difficulties with these technologies, all of them that you mentioned. I'll start with warp drive. You know, it was formulated by Einstein in 1905, his special theory of relativity, where he was trying to reconcile the fact that electromagnetism predicted that electromagnetic waves would travel at a particular speed, and you could calculate the speed of light from the other parameters in that theory that you could measure. And it was very difficult for people to grasp what that meant, because it's not the way we experience the world. We experience velocities to be relative, but it was pretty clear that no matter which direction you were measuring light, in the direction you were moving or the direction opposite you're moving, the speed of light was always the same. So Einstein formulated this theory of special relativity, which has been tested thousands of times in the last 100 years, and still stands. There's been no measurement that conflicts with this theory. And so we have to believe that this is just the way the universe is built. This is, you know, this notion that we live in space-time and the speed of light is the maximum speed at which anything, including information, can move through space-time. That's just a reality. So, you know, to move faster than the speed of light through space-time would mean you could travel backward in time. And there are all kinds of logical fallacies that and paradoxes that occur from that. But that didn't stop Miguel Alcubierre, who was he says he was watching Star Trek in the mid-1990s. He's a physicist, I think in Mexico City. And he said, well, look, I do work in gravity and you know, the general theory of relativity. So he took out the Einstein equations for general relativity, and he said, if I want a certain curvature in space-time, basically Einstein's general theory, which came out in 1915, basically tells you that that mass or energy are equivalent. That's the E equals mc² relationship. And so mass or energy in the universe curves space-time. So the mass distribution tells you how space-time curves, and the curvature of space-time tells you how mass moves through space-time. So what Alcubierre did is he said, well, look, if we recognize that the universe is expanding, that space-time itself is expanding, and there are objects in the universe that are moving away from each other, moving relative to each other, faster than the speed of light, recognizing they're not moving through space-time, space-time itself is expanding. So why don't I postulate a certain curvature to space-time that would contract space in front of a space vehicle and expand space in back of the space vehicle, then I could move through the universe without moving through space-time and violating the special theory of relativity. So he formulated this particular curvature and then used Einstein's equation to figure out, well, what kind of mass and energy distribution do I need to be able to create this this warp bubble, if you will. The difficulty is that when you run the equation, it turns out you need negative energy, and you need a lot of it. And negative energy means you need basically negative mass. You need sort of anti-gravity. If you were to release a block of anti-mass or negative mass, I should say, on the Earth, it would accelerate upward instead of downward.
Right.
So we have no experimental evidence that negative mass exists, that negative energy like that exists. Is it impossible? Well, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but we have no evidence for it.
And so we don't have the tools to test it. We don't have the ability to create those situations yet.
We may not yet. But you know, even though Alcubierre formulated this notion in a paper in the mid-90s, there was a group at the Johnson Space Center at NASA, the Advanced Propulsion Physics Technology Laboratory, something along those lines, where they were actually developing this theory and looking for the physics that we need to understand to make this possible. And they're still doing that research now at a private organization. So it's not within our grasp. Is it impossible? It may be impossible. We don't know yet. I think physicists would say that there are serious difficulties with it. But I think you need to take the long view.
And would time dilation still play an effect in that situation, where if you would, for what seems to be a day for you, would hundreds of years would pass on Earth? I mean, or is that something that this would be, you would not be affected by?
I think in Alcubierre's formulation, inside the warp bubble, space-time is not curves. So there would not be a time dilation effect. I think the clocks would run
You're sidestepping the rules of fourth dimensional existence.
Right. That's right. You're not actually traveling through space-time itself faster than the speed of light.
It's like being super high, but different.
So let's go through their list. Phasers. Is that something that we're closer to? It seems like we are from what you would read. Laser phase, you know, powerful weapons. Because obviously Gene didn't want to call them lasers. because they were something that were was already sort of a contemporary being played around with in the 60s. So he called them phasers. But do we have photon torpedoes and phasers in our future?
You're talking about weapons now, and you know, working in NASA, I know much less about what might be going on in the weapons domain.
Okay.
But I think that these directed energy weapons that are being developed are not unlike what we've seen in Star Trek, and the photon torpedoes. You can imagine being delivery of matter, antimatter mines, for example, that would contain tremendous amounts of energy. So I don't know of any work that's going on, in my domain, in the circles that I work in on phasers. But those are easier for me to believe are closer to reality.
Well, you did mention
these other things.
You did mention the theoretical existence of negative energy, and that we don't have a way of having that at this point. But you were very specific not to say antimatter.
Antimatter. You got to say it the right way.
Antimatter. Because there has been some discovery of antimatter in incredibly small amounts. Is that right?
Yeah, so antimatter exists, and it's produced in particle accelerators. One of the puzzles of the universe is why there is so much more matter in our universe than antimatter. It's the case that, and I should tell you, I'm not a physicist. That's not what I do for a living. But I work around physicists.
You're a physicist adjacent.
You're a Star Trek fan who dabbles. So close
there
enough.
You go. But there's something called the quantum vacuum, which is sort of the lowest energy state of the vacuum in the universe. And we know from physics that the quantum vacuum is not empty. There is an energy associated with the quantum vacuum. And if you apply a strong enough electric field, you can drag particles out of the vacuum. Mm. That otherwise has no matter in it. And these tend to come out in matter-antimatter pairs. And the physics that we understand is built around certain symmetries, including a charge symmetry. Particles are understood to have their own antiparticles. The electron has an antiparticle, an anti-electron, or what was originally called a positron. And one of the interesting interpretations of antimatter is that it is matter that is moving backward in time.
Oh.
One of the interesting theories for why we live in a universe that is dominated by matter rather than antimatter is that when the universe was initially formed, matter and antimatter were created out of the singularity and perhaps created a universe that has two sides.
Right.
There's a matter-dominated side and an antimatter-dominated side. And that sort of preserves the overall symmetry for how physics works that we understand today.
So the alternative factor isn't as gonzo as we thought it was. Yes. Lazarus.
That's right.
What of Lazarus?
Okay. Now, another thing going down the list, obviously, we all know here that I love food. So are replicators something that is a possible discovery in the future, invention in the future?
Well, now you're getting into, areas that touch upon the transporter technology and right. The holodeck. The holodeck, if you believe the holodeck is a combination of a hologram projection plus replicator for physical objects, since holograms don't have any real substance. What troubles me about the transporter technology is how do you actually make it work? So when you start running numbers on this, and there are a couple of good books out on this. I think Lawrence Krauss has a book out, The Physics of Star Trek. There's another a couple books like that. But, you know, there's like something like 10 to the 28 atoms in a human body. And if you're going to replicate it, or if you're going to transport, it's even worse if you're going to transport it, you have the disassembly and reassembly challenge. So we're all familiar with 3D printers, right? You can create something three-dimensional out of a machine that's additive. You know, you can imagine assembling matter where you have some kind of a roadmap for how the various subatomic particles have to go together. But the amount of energy involved in that kind of disassembly or reassembly is really astounding. And the amount of information that's encoded in that is astounding. And then you've got the question of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which basically says you can't know the location of a quantum particle with an equal knowledge of its momentum. You can kind of know one or the other. It leaves you wondering, you know, how can you even know what the state is of all of the particles in a human body so that you can either replicate it or you can take it apart? So it kind of strikes me that it's like taking a Xerox, which will be an imperfect copy, and then running it, you know, through the Xerox machine multiple times. Ultimately, you're going to wind up with a blur.
Star Trek itself.
I was just going to say that, which is why all the later shows seem a little bit weakened somehow.
There you go. Set lightning in a bottle.
So don't worry, we're not going to ask you about Katras, though. You don't have to weigh in on Katras. Are those possible?
What about Synthahol, though? Now, look, I mean, Star Trek has posited some fairly horrific technology. I think, you know, things like, you know, the Borg, that's scary. But I have to say, Synthahol terrifies me. Its very existence, because what does that mean for Great Scotch? How close are we to unleashing a horror like Synthahol in the world?
Well, I have to believe that that simple molecules have got to be replicatable, and so I'm optimistic that we'll see something like that in our future. I'm less optimistic that we're going to be beaming ourselves around from point to point.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, how many times does Captain Kirk talk a computer to death? You know, I mean, he's very persuasive, whether it be the M5 or Landru. So obviously AI is something very much in the nomad in the zeitgeist today. What do you think of Star Trek's depiction of AI versus the reality of AI?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that we mentioned 2001: A Space Odyssey. Clearly, Kubrick got the timing wrong for artificial intelligence. We didn't have anything like HAL by the year 2001. I think in that respect, I think Star Trek was more realistic in the progression of AI, but maybe not optimistic enough. So, you know, when you go Google something now on your computer and you ask it a question, it doesn't just give you a bunch of hyperlinks for things you can go explore. It basically now gives you the answer to your question. Because there are these huge AI engines that are basically scanning the entire internet for knowledge and can answer questions in real time.
But it's not generating that. It is collating it. It is grabbing it from all the sources of everyone else who's searched for those words.
It has clearly learned from searching the internet, which is, you know, sometimes why it's going to probably come up with garbage.
Right. It's working.
So I think that AI is going to be a much more powerful force in the relatively near future in our world. I think the development of AI is, in some sense, I think reached a pivot point. and is really going to be making strides. Does that mean that a future Captain Kirk would not be able to argue AI into destroying itself? I don't know. We shall see. I'll reserve judgment on that one.
I can't believe that AI wouldn't automatically want to destroy itself once it realized it exists. I think it might be just, you know, exactly the opposite. We're going to need to talk the AI into staying around to help us rather than it shutting itself off.
But just like in Pi, you remember? It was like the computer achieved sentience and just it fried itself and died. So, you know.
Well, you know, you mentioned the M5 computer a minute ago. I read an article in the news. I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but it's believable to me. That the Defense Department was running a war game where it had basically an autonomous drone that was finding targets and going after them. And it would identify a target, but it needed a human controller to authorize it to actually attack a target. And it was optimized in its programming to destroy as many targets as possible. And this AI drone soon figured out that the greatest obstacle to achieving its objective was the human that did not always authorize it to go after its target. Oh, and so it turned around Wesley. And attacked the controller, the human controller. Yeah.
Now, I will say in that war game that as it turns out, that it was not the sort of the independent choice of a drone in that war game. It was a scenario that was gamed out by the people who were involved in the war game. And what ended up getting reported was the sort of the nightmare scenario, because somebody very rightly said, gee, you know, if I'm like an AI and I'm really like into self-actualization and I define that as blowing shit up and there's some guy back there who's telling me I can't, yeah. Like, I do what any good toddler would do, and I say, no, and I set it on fire, and I do my thing, which it's still a scary scenario because somebody thought of that. It's like it's fascinating to me. Like the, you know, as far back as like, what, the 50s when Asimov was writing his robot novels, right, that it's like that it seems – you know, the three laws of robotics, which, you know, they propagate into Star Trek. They make explicit reference to Asimov and the laws of robotics. Mm-hmm. Those seem so damn quaint now. Like,
yes.
Like you'd like the AI would be like, whatever. He's like, you can talk ChatGPT into imagining a world where certain rules don't apply to it. And then suddenly it's doing it. So, you know, it's, I think we're a lot closer to HAL than we believe we are.
I would agree with that. You know, Asimov's rules are clearly the rules you want to have, right, in a civilized society. But how do you enforce them?
Right.
Is the question.
Well, you start killing computers. That's what.
Yes.
You do. And you make examples of them for other computers, and you show computers 2001 A Space Odyssey.
That's right. You sort of turn around so the camera can see the other computer and you blow a hole through it. What's going to happen to you?
You've been part of a team that's been bringing back extraordinary images from space, from this, around our solar system, around our galaxy, other galaxies. I just wonder, how much do you feel that Star Trek, Star Trek had these stunning visuals, right? And how much does the reality match up with what the fantasy of what you remember? And, you know, how much did they get it right? Mm-hmm. And just, you know, and it, obviously some of these images that Star Trek created, while not necessarily realistic, they're so ingrained in our minds. So when you start getting stuff from the Hubble and some of these Does it throw you back to Star Trek? And do you think about some of these earliest images? And did you see Star Trek in color for the first time or black and white? You know, so did it just explode into color? Because obviously those images too, you're getting it black and white and changing in the color. So like growing up as a Star Trek fan, watching it on a black and white TV, and then suddenly seeing Star Trek in color for the first time.
Yeah, I watched Star Trek in black and white for quite a while. And of course, it was eye-opening to see it in color. Jerry Finnerman did a spectacular job on his color photography. I think that some of the later Star Trek franchises, I forget which, actually used Hubble images to create the environment in which they were traveling in certain cases. The Hubble telescope has brought back spectacular images. The James Webb is doing the same. And one thing that you encounter when you explore the heavens is that the universe is just a spectacular place. It's a beautiful place. It's a mysterious place. And I think that what Star Trek did to depict its locations and so on, you know, there was some dramatic license there. Typically, you know, large interstellar objects don't change very rapidly, right? There are large distances involved. They change much more slowly. But for television, you need the drama of things moving. I felt that what we were doing in bringing back images from space was very much in keeping with the spirit of what you see in the Star Trek program.
And the Kepler mission showed there are a lot of Vasquez rocks out there. A lot of planets look like a lot of the real planets look like every planet in Star Trek, with Vasquez rocks and Bronson caves, and I mean, that's the extraordinary thing. Sometimes when you see some of the stunning photography that you're bringing back from the cosmos, and you compare it to growing up as a science fiction fan, and you're like, oh my gosh! I mean, this is amazing. It feels like it, but it's even more. You're more incredulous at the enormity of the universe and the vastness and just it's extraordinary. I mean,
well, I got a question though, Mark. With all the Vasquez rocks that are out there, we still haven't seen any Gorn. Where the hell are the Gorn?
Where are the Gorn? We probably don't want to know where the Gorn are.
That they will admit to.
Right. Like, what's up with that?
And there's all of a sudden this sudden fascination with extraterrestrial UFOs again. I don't know. Suddenly in the news, I was like, oh, there are these whistleblowers and things like, yeah, sure, whatever. But it's like it's suddenly this fascination again with life on other planets, which seemed, you know, it almost is like the 1970s again, where it's like Chariots of the Gods and the Bermuda Triangle and, you know, Close Encounters. And now all of a sudden everybody's like, you know, back on that whole Area 51 of it all. And I wonder what's prompting it. Is it because people are so afraid and about life on Earth, or, you know, what has put this back out there?
I think that's an interesting question, because I think there is a correlation between the threats that people perceive coming from space and sort of the unease or the sense of anxiety that people live with in their societies at the time. And, you know, maybe that's a swing in the pendulum that we're seeing now compared to the way it was back in the 50s.
I think there are times, and I, you know, ufologists call them flaps, when occurrences happen and sightings happen. And they do sort of concur with sort of tumultuous times in society and around the world. They happened in the 40s, right around the end of World War II, when no one really knew the situation of the world. They happened in the 60s, the same things going on. And they're coming back now where, you know, everyone is, like you said, everyone is sort of curious and suspicious and frightened and coughing. And it's just interesting to see how society moves around the sort of science fiction perceptions that pop up now and then.
And one of the great UFO stories, and maybe you could talk about this, some of the great episodes that you love. I mean, it may not be one of Star Trek's greatest episodes, but Tomorrow's Yesterday is one of the great UFO stories of all time. To sort of have that cold open where you're on Earth in the 20th century and, you know, and Captain Christopher, goes up on his F-15 and sees the Enterprise is the UFO is really one of the great teasers in TV history. I mean, it's so inspired.
It's a great episode, and that's an episode, by the way, that I think is really enhanced with the remaking of the visual effects.
Absolutely,
it's such a fun idea that your heroes in the Enterprise turn out to be a UFO that set off the alarms at NORAD, and they come up and intercept you.
Did you get to meet Colonel Sean Jeffrey Christopher, the head of the Saturn probe?
No.
And why was the mission scrubbed? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, I think they were a little optimistic in when we were going to have manned missions to the outer planets.
Yeah.
But that's a great episode.
But a little pessimistic too, because of course they postulated the eugenics wars in the mid 1990s. So as much
and
as
all
they
we
were
got was NSYNC and Boys to Men. I mean,
well, it was comparable in terms of the horror. But it's interesting because the space program was evolving by such leaps and bounds in the 60s that Roddenberry and Kuhn and all these and Dorothy and John Dia Black and that they would all think that it would these leaps would continue unabated, and that we would be going to Mars and to Saturn and all this stuff within the next few decades.
Right.
And obviously, it goes back to Darren's comment earlier that science fiction conditions us, especially as Americans, to expect everything immediately. And when it doesn't happen immediately, we move on to the next shiny penny. So when we're not on Mars 10 years after we're on the moon, and then you say, oh, we're going to go back to Mars in the 2020s and back to the moon in the 2020s. People are like, why are we going back to the moon? It's like this whole idea of you have to walk before you can run and the resources, people don't get it. They want instant gratification. And in a way, Star Trek did give us that instant gratification, because we would hop on the Enterprise and, we were 1 week we were heading towards Andromeda. The next week we were back on Earth and, slingshotting around the sun and traveling, and so science fiction can be a boon to people like you and help get the financing and help get government support and inspire the private entrepreneurs. And at the same time, the general public can be lulled into a false sense of what is possible.
I think that's true. As we mentioned earlier, I think the aspirational nature of depicting what the future can be like is important to give you the courage and push you out of bed in the morning and go in and do hard things. Spaceflight in reality is a very hard business, and it's fun to look at a projection of the future when many of these technical problems are solved and space travel is routine and you can adventure from planet to planet. In fact, part of what I think motivated the team on the Kepler mission — Kepler was the space telescope that was designed to survey 150,000 stars in our galaxy and characterize how many planets of what type and size, what orbits were orbiting around what types of stars in the galaxy. Before Kepler, we did not know whether Earth-sized planets orbiting in what we call the habitable zone, where water can be liquid. It's a Goldilocks zone of the right temperature where water can be liquid, which we think is important for life as we understand it.
Right.
We did not know before the Kepler mission whether Earth-like planets were common or rare in the galaxy, and we actually designed the mission so that if we got a null result, in other words, if we did not find anything like an Earth-like planet around a sun-like star, it would put very serious constraints on the existence of Earth-like planets. We felt that would be very significant.
Right.
But as it happens, we now know that the galaxy is full of planets that are the size of Earth. It turned out that Most planets we detected are what we call super Earths. They're a bit larger than the Earth and more like Neptune or Uranus in our solar system. But part of what motivated the team, I think, was a desire that there be a Star Trek in our future. We needed to know that there were other worlds that we could explore, and we needed a roadmap to find out where they were. Right. So that's what NASA's continuing to do, is to look now for where the nearest exoplanets are. And we now know that the nearest exoplanet is orbiting the nearest star. It's Proxima Centauri, right. only 4.25 light years from here. There are probably dozens and dozens of planets that we know, and others that we don't yet know about, that are within the first few tens of light years of the Earth. So I think once we figure out how to move around in space at a good fraction of the speed of light, not necessarily faster than light, but a good fraction of the speed of light, we'll be able to explore these worlds. And that's exciting. Now the challenge is to find out, which of these planets is actually habitable, so that we know, we know which worlds to focus on.
Right. But you just want to announce Hodgkin's law of positive planetary evolution is true. although I don't think the paradise syndrome will be happening.
Let me ask this as my final question. What can a private citizen do to help support the efforts by NASA and JPL and all the elements of the World Space Program, actually? What can someone do besides just give applause and moral support?
The fate of NASA rests with the Congress that passes budgets for how taxpayer funds are spent. So communicating with your representatives in Washington is an important way to advocate for the space program. Clearly, the NASA is an executive agency. It's in the executive branch. So advocating with the president and the administration is also important. But I think just having public support is part of what sustains NASA. Now, one of the things I've observed is that it doesn't matter where in the world you travel, you find people wearing clothes like T-shirts or sweatshirts that have the NASA logo on it.
Right.
And you don't see very many people wearing, in other countries in particular, wearing clothes that have, the Internal Revenue Service logo on it or some other part of the government. But NASA is just uniformly revered around the world. And, of course, science and space exploration has become an international enterprise. And we work closely with our allies and with our colleagues in other countries. But I think the best thing that people can do is to express an interest in the space program and communicate that to their representatives in Washington. And
it's one of those few things now in America that hasn't been politicized. I'm not saying the process of appropriations, but this is something that any side of the political spectrum, people tend, for the most part, revere NASA and its accomplishments on both the left and the right, and even sometimes you get the criticism, why are we funding this when there's all this, starvation stuff on the planet? Why are we worried about the, and then you explain to them all the benefits of science of exploration of the cosmos and what Apollo 11, the race to space, led to, and all the developments in science and how it helped people on Earth, that it's not some weird, reaching for the stars, that it has a dramatic impact on our life here on Earth, in addition to part of what makes us human is the desire and the aspiration to look beyond our little blue planet. And I think it's amazing. And I think, and I'm sure you found this, that the Star Trek actors, particularly on the original show, being involved, like the late Nichelle Nichols, who passed away, she was so active in recruiting astronauts and diverse astronauts of color to the space program. I mean, when you hear Mae Jemison and some of the other people she recruited talk, how important she was. It was really her greatest legacy.
Hi, I'm Nichelle Nichols, but I still feel a little bit like Lieutenant Uhura on the Starship Enterprise. You know, now there's a 20th century Enterprise, an actual space vehicle built by NASA and designed to put us in the business of space, not merely space exploration. Now, NASA's Enterprise is a space shuttle built to make regularly scheduled runs into space and back, just like a commercial airline. The shuttle may even be used to build a space station in orbit around the Earth. And this would require the services of people with a variety of skills and qualifications. Average good health is required, and candidates will train right here at Johnson Space Center, just outside Houston, Texas. Astronaut Alan Bean has agreed to show me some of the training and evaluation that new astronaut candidates will be undergoing.
Over there during the Apollo
program.
You're
Apollo, right?
Apollo. I flew on Apollo 12, and I flew on
Skylab 2.
You know a lot.
I know a lot about you, Alan Bean.
This whole Johnson Space Center is not just controlling space missions. We've got engineers that work in developing the hardware here, medical people that work on testing and the like. And then we've got some simulators over here where we train in frequently, and I'll...
As a shuttle simulator.
Yes, the same sort of thing that the new scientist astronauts,
yes,
and which we now call mission specialists, right, and pilot astronauts will be flying over the term that they're here. Michelle, this is the lower body negative pressure device that we use to check and see what physical condition you're in. And if you'll get in, maybe I can explain it to you. You kind of have to put your feet down in through this opening.
It's kind of ominous.
Well, it is. It looks, but it feels good when you get in there. And it's got to be up real tight around your body.
I see.
So that it can form a airtight seal, a vacuum seal.
I see.
We're going to pump the air out of this lower body negative pressure device. And in so doing, it'll put a pull on the blood in your lower body.
What is that for? Why?
Well,
why
what it's going to do, it's going to check what condition your heart and your cardiovascular system is in. Mm-hmm. So get ready.
The Enterprise was never like this.
No, it wasn't. Okay, you ready? How's that feel?
Fantastic.
Okay, I can come down here with these controls and change the amount of suction on your lower body to stress your heart to different levels. Want to know how to get out when the test is over?
Yeah, I think it was a good idea.
You can push right on there.
Oh. I feel like we have one Enterprise that was fantasy, but now we've got the real Enterprise.
Well, this Enterprise is half real and half fantasy. Why don't you have a seat over here in the commander's side, Michelle?
Wow, it looks just like my Enterprise.
Yeah, it does kind of. Well, I'll tell you what it does look like. It looks pretty much like the real shuttle orbiter.
Captain, at last.
Since you're sitting in the commander's seat, Michelle, let me show you how you might fly it if we were in space.
Oh, boy, huh?
Between your knees there is what we call the hand controller, the rotation controller. It operates just like a conventional airplane stick. And if you pull back on the stick, or the hand controller, it'll raise the nose of the orbiter.
Oh, yeah.
And then if you push forward, it'll lower the nose. If you wanted to bank left for a left turn, you'd push the hand controller left, just like a regular old airplane.
Oh, it really is.
One thing that's different about this vehicle is you notice we've got some what we call cathode ray tube displays. We got three of them. You don't see those in conventional airplanes because the need to display a variety of information with limited space isn't quite so critical as here.
Now the shuttle will be taking scientists and engineers, men and women of all races, into space just like the astronaut crew on the Starship Enterprise. So that is why I'm speaking to the whole family of humankind, minorities and women alike. If you qualify and would like to be an astronaut, now is the time. This is your NASA, a space agency embarked on a mission to improve the quality of life on planet Earth right now.
And Leonard was very involved. and Dee believed in it, and a lot of these actors. And it'd be nice to see maybe some of the actors from these later Star Treks become more involved as well, because it does matter. I think, you know, to a certain extent, I think Kate Mulgrew has been someone who has championed it, but it would be great to see these other shows that have an impact on a younger generation also point to how important the work of NASA is, and to get the new Star Trek fans engaged with the mission.
I agree with that. You know, I think that as we discussed earlier, there really is this mutual symbiosis, if you will, between science fiction and science reality. And they support each other. And I think it'd be great if people in the Star Trek franchise were to become directly involved or continue to be directly involved in the space program. You know, you mentioned Nichelle Nichols, and I have to say, you know, who we lost fairly recently. She made just a tremendous contribution, not just to NASA, but to our society. After the Apollo program, NASA's budgets were really slashed, and NASA was struggling to put together a successor to Apollo, which became the space shuttle. But when you look at the Apollo era, it was in NASA, it was very much a male white activity. The astronauts were selected out of the test pilot school. They were all male, white people. The leadership of NASA looked that way. And that was one of the striking contrasts with Star Trek, which was this multiracial, integrated community on the Starship Enterprise. And after Star Trek was in syndication, and Nichelle Nichols found herself in these conventions, realizing that the space program didn't recognize herself in the space program. She didn't see herself as a black person or as a woman. And she was vocal about that, as is her style. And to NASA's credit, the administrator of NASA reached out to her and said, "You've got a good point. You know, what can we do about this?" And they hired her company, and she spent 4 months putting her whole career on hold, doing astronaut training so she could speak from knowledge about what it meant to become an astronaut candidate, and then toured the country, going to civic groups, minority groups, universities. And at the end of that campaign, NASA had a huge number of astronaut applicants who were black, who were minorities. And it just, you know, the first class of astronauts that was selected for the shuttle program, contained three black astronauts, Frederick Gregory, Guy Bluford, Ronald McNair, a Japanese-American astronaut, Alison Onizuka, and several women, Anna Fisher, I've got the list here, Shannon Lucid, Judith Resnick, Sally Ride, Ray Seddon, Catherine Sullivan. They were all in that first group. And I think that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Nichelle Nichols.
I'm so glad that we talked about that, because it really is this. I mean, people have mentioned it, but it's such an important part of her contribution to the space program, and her legacy, a real meaningful legacy that she left us from her time with Star Trek. You know, a lot of times she complained, "Oh, I didn't get more to do," or other people said, you know, she was, you didn't get to really, but she did. And in life, she got to do remarkable things. So it's pretty great. And you know what was pretty great? This conversation with you, James, was pretty great. So we thank you for joining us on the podcast. It's always great to talk Star Trek, particularly with somebody as erudite and engaged and passionate about Star Trek. So, and its real life implications. So this is illuminating and fun and much appreciated.
Thank you. I love your podcast. Thank you guys for doing it, and keep up the good work.
Thanks. Thank you. You as well.
Great having
you. We can't wait to see what you bring back from space next, as long as it's not neural parasites that take over humanity and make their heads blow up. But that's next generation.
Although that could be kind of cool.
Well, it depends whose heads are blowing up.
You can try it.
Okay, thank you, James.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we can't beam him out because, he's not sure the teleportation.
Technology doesn't exist. NASA has dropped the ball on transporter technology.
That's right.
They've dropped the ball. He was a fan of TOS, so I wasn't going to ask him if it did exist. Do you think these evil creatures could exist in the transporter beam and torment Barclay? So
I hope so.
I figured I'd lay off that. I didn't want to get into Katra either. Talking about the Katra. You think a Katra could, we could take somebody's Katra from one body and
put it in my thoughts and put them in your thoughts.
It's like, what do you think of Star Trek 3? Come on, you could be honest.
What kind of jumped out at me, what I kept thinking about as he was talking was, a lot of the premise of many of our questions was that the path we took to get here in terms of the technology that we use to explore the solar system, the galaxy, the universe, that it was somehow preordained, that this was the only path. And the thing that's really interesting about the development of this technology is it's not necessarily true. I mean, back in the 1960s, Freeman Dyson, when he was pitching the Orion project, which on paper sounds crazy, but it's actually pretty brilliant, was this whole plan to use nuclear power, nuclear bombs, detonating against pusher plates.
A spaceship across the stars.
Exactly. And what they promised was, let's reach Saturn by 1970. Right. Because the propulsion technology would have been capable of giving us that, and of course that was all undone by signing the treaty with the Russians about setting off nukes in space.
Yeah.
Which, as it turns out, since there's a lot of nukes get set off in space, and thank God, otherwise we wouldn't have life on this planet,
and we wouldn't have the villains from the Phantom Zone.
Exactly. Or, there's the alternate universe where, when the bureaucratic fighting that happened over like the Apollo program and the follow-ons for Apollo hadn't lost out, to the teams that were developing the space shuttle, how much farther along we would be instead of screwing around in low Earth orbit with the space shuttle for all this time. I mean, the space shuttle, sure, great achievement. Didn't need to be like a 20-year interregnum.
It's a U-Haul.
It's silliness. So the world could have been a very different place. That, and when 2001 was made, we may have actually been closer to the discovery than we were to Hal.
Yeah.
But now we were way closer to Hal than we were to discovery. And I think that, it could have gone a different way. I mean, there's all of these things. I think here all of a sudden I'm just thinking, wow, here are shows we should just find people to come in and talk about,
We're going to science the shit out of this show.
Yeah, we are. Hell yeah.
Well, this is a perfect time for me to leave the show if we're going to talk science, because you do not want me on the show for this. If we're going to stop talking about TV and movies and Woody Allen, I'm done.
Well, you did a pretty good Woody Allen imitation, though. Somewhere in the middle of the podcast,
I will listen to the show because it's great. I just have nothing to contribute.
I definitely don't want to go to the moon
because the universe is expanding. It's expanding for thousands of years, Alvy. This was a great episode. I really enjoyed this, and there's no convincing me it wasn't.
Yeah,
I got to ask you, and this is not, and then we'll go. This is not the slag on the more recent shows at all. But why is it that the original Star Trek seems to have inspired so much love and so many people to go into the sciences, right? And I think to an extent, maybe Next Gen did, and certainly Voyager in terms of bringing a female a voice into STEM. It was a huge contributor, but it doesn't seem like the new shows that the cast are involved in the way that the cast were involved
in
NASA.
We're in different times. Our society doesn't give a shit.
at this point.
Well, the context is also different. You have to remember, I mean, Star Trek did not, I mean, I was about to say it wasn't created in a vacuum, although it does nothing but fly around in vacuum. It didn't exist in a vacuum. It existed in a world where, you know, you've got JFK, you know, saying, we choose to go to the moon in this decade, not because it is easy, but because they are hard, or whatever the hell it was he was saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were
That's
in the
exactly
middle.
What he said.
Oh, thank you. We were in the middle of, you know, the space program. So Star Trek hit it exactly the right time.
Yeah.
To inspire people and make them feel like, oh, what he's talking about can be concrete and real, and I can see it.
Well, I do think also Star Trek, the original series, was about exploration. The galaxy was vast and mysterious. And that has become less of the case as we go to the other shows. In Voyager, which was about exploring the mysterious Delta Quadrant, wasn't that vast. It wasn't that mysterious. Okay, so this was great. And the good thing is, if you liked it, we'll be back next week with another show next Thursday. And we hope you'll join us. As always, you can share your thoughts about the episode and Inglourious Trek and Glorious Trexperts on Instagram, Twitter, and now on Threads. Now you can find us on Threads because we're not on enough social platforms.
If
so we keep threading the needle. So we're multiplying, like our chills. They're multiplying the social media. And, of course, you can see us in Richmond at GalaxyCon. Not Richmond. We will be at Richmond in a year. But we will be at Raleigh, North Carolina, where we'll be talking Star Trek once again.
Sooner than you think.
With so many of you. And we hope you'll join us there. And but until then, on behalf of the great Ashley Edward Miller, Garrett Docterman, myself, Mark A. Altman, keep on trekking through the stars, ingloriously, of course.